At least two things are true about American infrastructure right now. One, millions of you are very likely dealing with some of its unpleasantness today. Potholed streets and aging highways, dingy airports, wondering how you'll survive 3 days with family in places where the broadband is spotty. Don't worry, you will survive. The second thing is this. A lot of those problems will hopefully be repaired in the next 10 years, thanks to the $1 trillion Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act.
Things are going to turn around in a big way. For example, because of this law, next year will be the first year in 20 years American infrastructure investment will grow faster than China's. We'll once again have the best roads, bridges, ports, and airports over the next decade.
Well, that's what President Biden asserted a week ago Monday, standing in front of the White House as he signed the Infrastructure Act into law. It's a pretty big claim. The best roads, bridges, ports, and airports in just 10 years? But that promise, specifically to beat China, is something Biden has said over and over and over again, way back in February, as Biden was trying to corral Democrats to get moving on infrastructure. He said in the Oval Office, quote, "You know, if we don't get moving, China's going to eat our lunch." Then, October 5th in Howell, Michigan.
Take China, for example. Now, I've been clear that China uses unfair coercive practices to get ahead in their competitors, but that's not the whole of the story. They also invest in themselves. In recent years, China has spent around 3 times as much on infrastructure as a share of their economy than we have. 3 times.
Then, November 16th, a few days after signing the Infrastructure Act into law, Biden visited a rusty 82-year-old bridge in Woodstock, New Hampshire, and repeated his bold promise.
For most of the 20th century, we led the world by significant margin because we invested in ourselves. But somewhere along the way, we stopped investing in ourselves. We've risked losing our edge as a nation, and China and the rest of the world are catching up, in some cases passing us. Well, we're about to turn things around in a big way. For example, because of this law, next year will be the first year in 20 years that American infrastructure investment will grow faster than China's, for example. And we'll once again have the best roads, bridges, ports, and airports.
There it is again. The best roads, bridges, ports, and airports. Time for a reality check. Just how far ahead are some infrastructure systems in China's major cities? Well, over in Shanghai, Jun Zhu says,
It's like light years.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and sure, a lot of Biden's proclamations are to be expected after a big political win. But he's also making a very specific claim that American infrastructure will surpass China's in, say, a decade. So, specifically then, what's the infrastructure like in China's cities right now? Well, Jun Zhu was born in Shanghai. She moved to the United States as a kid, then moved back to Shanghai in 2003. She's seen the city's rapid development.
The roads are very good compared to the U.S. I feel like the Chinese government really spends resources on maintaining the road. I've always been really impressed by how they spend the effort to kind of decorate the highway. Like on the dividers, there are these beautiful roses, which, like right now, and it's just, you might be stuck in traffic and I'm like looking at the flowers and it's just impressive. Like you see people maintaining it and watering it on the truck. The traffic is not great in Shanghai, but just any major city. But in general, the roads are great. Like if there are potholes, it gets maintained. No complaints about the roads.
Zhu doesn't have any complaints about Shanghai's subway system either.
In general, I find the China subway has a very good coverage. It's very clean. And over the years, it's also gotten a lot more orderly in terms of people lining up to get on the subway. So it's, in general, a very pleasant experience. I also comment about, you know, visited places like London and the subway is like really hot during the summer. And I know that they can't figure out the AC system or cooling system. So it's because the infrastructure is much older.
To be fair, the Shanghai Metro opened to riders in 1993, 130 years after the London Underground began operating in 1863. But let's focus again on the United States. One more point of comparison, Shanghai's metro trains are also faster, 21 to 25 miles per hour on average, versus the 20 down to the 7 miles per hour on average in Boston's metro system. But it's not just the trains and tracks themselves. In Shanghai, the subway is integrated into people's lives in a completely different way.
And a lot of the large high-rises are connected underground by subway. So when it's raining, and you can just walk underneath and get to kind of your destination, which I also find very convenient.
Jun Zhu is kind of meh, though, on China's airports. She says they're clean and functional, but lacking in character. She perks up, though, when talking about the transportation away from Shanghai's Pudong International Airport.
There is a, high-speed train, like the super high-speed train that goes from the airport to the city that I sometimes take from the airport.
She's talking about Shanghai's maglev train. Top speed, 430 kilometers per hour, or more than 260 miles per hour. So in general, when it comes to moving people around, Jun Zhu's grade for Shanghai,
from an infrastructure perspective, has all the ticked all the boxes.
That's Jun Zhu. She's in Shanghai. And the question is, can we here in the United States catch up to that in 10 years or in 15 years or in 20 years, as President Biden has promised? What will it take for American infrastructure to become truly world-class again? Well, joining us today is Nancy Chen. She's professor in the Kellogg School of Management, Managerial Economics, and Decision Sciences. She's with us from Chicago. Professor Chen, welcome to you.
Hello, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. And also with us today is Kevin DeGood. He's Director of Infrastructure Policy at the Center for American Progress, and he's with us from Washington. Kevin, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on the show today.
Okay, so I want to first ask you both. June said she thinks that some of Shanghai's infrastructure is literally light years ahead of infrastructure in parts of the United States. Essentially, how would you judge the distance between the two? And Professor Chen, let me start with you.
I would say that the infrastructure in Shanghai and Beijing, they're fantastic, and they're about exactly 100 years ahead of the United States. And that number I don't come up with by accident. The U.S.'s infrastructure, it's a little bit younger than the one in London, but much, much older than in China, right, when we think of Boston, New York, and Chicago.
100 years. I mean, ostensibly, the distance or the difference between the two would be less if maintenance had occurred over or adequate maintenance and modernization had occurred over that century. But Kevin DeGood, same question to you.
I don't know that I would put it in quite those terms.
Okay.
I had the pleasure of visiting Shanghai a number of years ago and riding the maglev train, and I found it to be an incredible experience. And I do agree that there is quite a bit of modern infrastructure there. I think the better question to ask, though, is, what is the most economically productive? What is the most socially and environmentally valuable? And, you know, quite honestly, we don't need to get to the airport that quickly, right? Going 240 or 260 miles an hour to get to an airport is not necessarily economically productive. And so these systems cost a great deal to build, but they also cost a lot to operate because the electrical demand of a maglev train is pretty extraordinary. Mm-hmm. So I think rather than just saying which is newer, which is older, or which is faster, which is slower, it should be more a question of what's the most cost-effective and economically productive.
Okay, so we're going to come back to that because cost, economic productivity, also obviously China's a huge country and there's a lot of divides between urban and rural there. We will talk about all of that. But let me just ask you, though, both then. President Biden, you heard, we played three different cuts in which he directly compared U.S. infrastructure to China's and over the past 10 days has been promising that because of the Infrastructure Act, that he says the U.S. is going to close the gap in 10 years. So, Professor Chen, fact check that. Do you think that's possible?
I don't think it's impossible. I think it is possible if American politicians and companies have the will to do this, because this requires a lot of coordination and a lot of money. And a lot of political and economic will. And, you know, I know we're coming back to this. I won't go into details, but I do agree with Kevin that, you know, the goal is not to do exactly what China does, but rather America's just overdue. It's long overdue for an upgrading, like an updating of its entire infrastructure system. And when it does that, it should do, you know, what makes sense for the U.S. And just to give you an example of how this might be difficult, and this is probably what President Biden has in mind when, you know, when he's thinking about U.S. infrastructure. During the Obama administration, there was a lot of discussion of infrastructure and maybe upgrading the New England corridor on Amtrak. So that's a place that's densely populated, which would make a lot of sense to just have a better, faster commuter rail for, you know, this area. And Amtrak estimated that it would cost over $117 billion. Mm. And they said that there would be cost overruns on top of that. And they didn't dare to estimate what those cost overruns would be. And that's just for the New England corridor, right? So I think it's doable for America to, America needs to have an updating. It's doable, but it's going to require a heck of a lot.
Yeah. So Kevin DeGood, same. I want to hear your response to this. And just to, we've got 40 seconds before the break. And just to remind folks, President Biden said that the U.S. will once again have the best roads, bridges, ports and airports in 10 years. Do you believe that?
It would be a stretch, but we could get there.
We could get there. Okay, so the question is how. So today, we are talking about this claim that President Biden has been making over the past 10 days, that the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act can help catapult American infrastructure at least to be somewhat on par, or even sometimes he's been saying the best in the world in at least in 10 years or so. Is that true? How do we get there? We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today we are taking a look at President Biden's assertion made after he signed the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, that trillion-plus-dollar historic investment in U.S. infrastructure, that the funding and the building that will happen because of this act could bring the United States infrastructure back up to world-class level, better than China's. The president is saying, in, say, the next 10 years. So we're checking that and then asking, what would it take to get there? We're getting a lot of response from you. For example, A.E. Walsh sent us this message online saying, landing in JFK after a week in Vienna, Austria really brought it home. JFK International Airport, of course. A week of great public transport in Austria, starting from the Vienna airport. And then the fact that U.S. major airports have no robust rail transport to major cities is a joke in the 21st century. Now, trains kept coming up because, as you'll know, yesterday I asked you, when you've been around the world, what are examples of infrastructure that you wish we had in the United States? And here's some of what you had to say.
This is Damon Jones. I'm calling from Hawaii. I'm retired military, and I remember living in Korea. The public transportation system was immaculate. We could travel the whole country on train and bus. We didn't own a car for 3 years.
In 2004, I had the opportunity to study abroad in Europe for 3 months. The rail system, specifically the high-speed rail system that was available 17 years ago, was light years ahead of what I could ever possibly have imagined.
Bangkok, the first time I went, blew my mind as far as the SkyTrain, the mass transit, subway systems. There's just no comparison.
I wish we had the train systems of France and Switzerland. That means you don't have to have a car. You can sit and watch the scenery go by and look at the landscape and never have to worry about being stuck in a traffic jam.
I would absolutely love to see the magnetic levitation train. whisper quiet, incredibly smooth, ridiculously fast. I'm kind of ashamed that we haven't figured that out.
Just a few of the On Point listeners out there who are longing for improvements in rail systems here in the United States. I'm joined today by Professor Nancy Chen. She's a professor in the Kellogg School of Management. And Kevin DeGood also joins us as well. He's Director of Infrastructure Policy at the Center for American Progress. Now, since that last listener just talked to us about maglev trains, Kevin, can we just focus for one more second on the lessons to be learned from that maglev train in Shanghai? I wasn't planning on focusing on it too much, but it keeps coming up because it's both sort of a wow factor and a cautionary tale. Now, full disclosure, I was in Shanghai in 2005, so it's been ages since I've been to China, but that's the last time I was there. What is it now? 16 years ago. I rode that train, and look, the one-time would-be engineer in me was just absolutely astonished, right? Like, you get on this train, you watch the speedometer on the train tick up, and it hits 430 kilometers an hour. It goes so fast that, like, the turns are have to be very steeply banked, and so your body's kind of tilting over at an angle. I mean, it's a marvel. It's an absolute marvel. But to your point, it only goes a couple of miles. Okay, so I took two lessons from that. One is it's a demonstration, I felt, as a foreigner in China, of China's ambition literally built into the fabric of its cities now. It was showing off. But also, why would we do that in the United States here? We would never do that for a train that only is supposed to go, like, what? It's less than 10 miles, right? So what are the lessons that we should be drawing, Kevin, from the fact that China could make a maglev train, and we still haven't even done one here in the United States?
Well, what you want out of your transportation system and what those listeners were really getting at, I think, is an issue of balance. And we have, you know, as a society, really since the passage of the Federal Aid Highway Act in 1956, you know, overbuilt our highway network. It's truly enormous and extensive. And we have underinvested in public transportation and intercity passenger rail. And one of the things that's great about the infrastructure bill that the president has recently signed into law is that it has $166 billion total for transit and for intercity passenger rail. And it has, you know, the kind of investments that we will benefit from for decades to come that won't just be on the Northeast Corridor between Washington, D.C. and Boston, but will truly help improve passenger rail service around the country. And those lines quite often have a dual use. You know, they're not only for intercity passenger rail service, but they also do daily commuter service, you know, in and out of our major metropolitan areas. So we're going to see real improvements, but I don't think we should get hung up and focused on one particular technology. Again, it's really about what can be a workhorse, what can help the economy grow. And the maglev train in Shanghai was as much an attempt at a demonstration for industrial export, right? The notion was that foreigners might come ride this system and then turn around and try to ask China to come and build it in their city. So it was part of an export model that never really took off. And part of the reason why it took off is, again, it's just not particularly practical, especially when you're thinking about truly national systems. You're not going to do that, you know, over thousands of miles or even hundreds of miles, because it's just not cost effective.
So, Professor Chen, then expand this analysis a little further about just, you know, various forms of transit in China's cities, light rail, subway, et cetera. I mean, how would you evaluate the quality of those? And how do the Chinese people see them? I mean, we're talking about economic development, affordability, things like that. I mean, does it work for the Chinese people?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And so the way the Chinese people see it is that urban transportation is very good, but there is agreement with what Kevin just said. You know, so the maglev is something that's like a wow, but it's not something that benefits most people, right? People look at it and they're very impressed and they're proud of their country, but most people don't use it. It's quite expensive and it only goes from, you know, the city center of Shanghai to one airport. I think the thing that really benefits people are the buses, which were upgraded in the big cities. They were upgraded more than a decade ago so that they have air conditioning. You know, they use electricity instead of, you know, burn fossil fuels. The subway system which is really fantastic, you know, on par with the best in Europe and Asia. You know, China's not unique in having great urban infrastructure. And as June said in your earlier clip, you know, these, the subway systems, the subways, the buses, they're fully integrated with each other, as well as with commuter trains, like not necessarily the maglev, but a train from one Shanghai to Hangzhou, you know, one city with over 10 million people to another huge city. And that really decreases the number of people on the highways, which is something that China really needs. And these are things that are low cost and that people use every day, like to get to work, you know, to have business meetings. And when I say integrated, they're not just integrated with each other, but there's also these huge underground tunnels. There's a whole city underground with affordable, you know, eating venues, with shops where you can buy everyday commodities, like, you know, pharmacies, or stationery shops for school kids. So, you know, this is really, there's really this whole integrated economic and transportation system.
And so how long, how much time did it take for that all this to happen, say, in a place like Shanghai? Is this within the last 20, 30 years?
Yes, it happened very quickly. So in Shanghai, I don't remember exactly the years, but the entire subway was built. The first few lines were built, you know, within 5 years, and the whole system was built within 10 years. And then, you know, all of the other things kind of just sprung up alongside it. And the same thing with Beijing. Beijing might even have been faster. Most of it was built before the Olympics.
Okay. So here's, you were hinting at this before, Professor Chen. While it's easy for us to be rather amazed to hear that an entire subway system was constructed in 5 to 10 years, there are, you know, that there are ways in which an authoritarian government can do that that cannot happen in a democracy, right? Just by, you know, by will, force, and planning, you just do it, and people don't have a choice. They probably have to move if their land is taken. So let me ask you then, though, so are there lessons that you can draw in terms of, let's say, the design of the integration that you're talking about that could be applicable as, you know, many metro areas in the United States now are thinking, well, what should we do, what can we do regarding transit with the money that they're going to get from the Infrastructure Act?
Yeah, so I think it's not just about... So authoritarian versus democracy, that's a bit of a shorthand. So I think what's really relevant here, it's not just the people losing their land or having, you know, to lose their house because, you know, the road is expanding. It's also just how, in addition, it's also how much control the government has over the economy, right, and development. So it's just able to coordinate a lot of real estate developers to get them to develop very quickly, you know, in the same place. And they're willing to do that because they all want to work with the government. And in the U.S., I think the specifics of the process would be different. But the general idea, I think the general lesson to learn is that you want to do it. You don't want to do it piece by piece. You need to do it all together, like city by city, state by state. And you would want to do it together so you can get the business side to buy in, like all together. And you would want them to compete for these contracts so that the prices come down. Like, you know, you don't want it to be monopolized by one company and do it piecemeal.
Yeah. So, Kevin, talk about this. I mean, how do we get closer to that kind of interstate even coordination?
Right. Well, I want to come back to, if I could for a second, this notion of building quickly, building with speed, and why I think we need to be aware that there can be some real perils and downsides to that. And I'll give you a historical example. So, in 1962, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers started working on a flood control project in Central Florida. The Kissimmee River that runs from the Lake Kissimmee south of Orlando down to Lake Okeechobee historically was this kind of beautiful 103-mile meandering river that had all sorts of wildlife and was surrounded by floodplains on either side. But in an attempt to sort of spur economic development and reduce the threat of flooding, the Army Corps was given this mission to turn that river into what really became a 56-mile-long stagnant drainage canal. And the Army Corps succeeded in reducing the threat of flooding, but it completely destroyed the ecology. And the damage was so great, in fact, that just 21 years after that river channelization project was completed, Congress authorized the beginning of the environmental restoration. Now, let's put some numbers on this. If we adjust for inflation, that channelization project was about $200 million today. The partial, and I stress partial, restoration is going to cost more than $1 billion. And part of the reason why we got this outcome is because we tried to move quickly and we didn't take the time to appropriately study what were going to be the consequences of this project. And could it be designed differently to serve a dual mandate of reducing the threat of flooding while at the same time providing for, you know, continued habitat and ecological services? So there's a reason why we took lessons from the sort of first 40 or 50 years of infrastructure development in this country and applied them to the second half. And that's really about review and public input and having this interactive, rich planning process, because we ultimately end up with better projects. So speed is not always our advantage if what we end up building, we have to go back and remediate with expensive fixes after the fact.
Yeah, point well taken there. I will also add, though, that a couple of months ago, we did a show about why the richness of public input into infrastructure projects. There are experts out there, analysts, who believe that it's one of the reasons why costs tend to rise quite dramatically for those same projects here in the United States. So folks, go to onpointradio.org to listen to that show. But what I do want to explore with both of you, again, with the, I take your point about not rushing projects. I really do. But at the same time, there is a sense of urgency. I mean, that's what President Biden keeps coming back at, about not just China, but infrastructure in many other parts of the world being sufficiently far ahead of the United States right now, that as we're discussing, there is this like feedback loop regarding economic growth as well. So, I mean, how much longer can we lag behind, Kevin? How much, how slow can the process be before it's going to be actually really hard to catch up, not just for infrastructure, but in continuing to propel the American economy into the 21st century?
Right. Yeah, it's a great question and an important one. But I think we should also recognize that it's not just about the total that we spend, but how well we spend that money. And there are plenty of projects out there which, rather than adding to the productive growth of our economy, ultimately have serve as a drag. They sort of have an overhang of cost that we have to carry for years and years. One other quick example that I think really brings this point forward. I'm from Ohio originally, and in Southeast Ohio, there's a county, Scioto County, that sits along the Ohio River. And in 2018, the Ohio Department of Transportation undertook the construction of a new highway right through the Appalachian Mountains there. It's State Route 823. It's also known as the Portsmouth Bypass. Now, this project cost $646 million to build, and Ohio DOT will spend another $600 million on operations and maintenance and debt service over the next 35 years under the contract they signed for that deal. Now, this is a major facility in an area that has a population which has been falling since the 1980s. Mm. And it also has lots and lots of other infrastructure, which is absolutely falling apart, right? The U.S. routes that go through Portsmouth now, their drinking water and wastewater systems. They also have a number of abandoned industrial sites from the early part of the 20th century that are contaminated, that need to be remediated so that they can be put back into productive economic use. And all of that is still sitting there incompleted because ODOT decided to build a new highway that will not produce economic development because they have a broken model of sort of if you build it, they will come.
Yeah.
So again, it's just this notion of we need to spend the money well. Mm. And that's where the conversation just gets a little more complicated. We tend to think that infrastructure spending is this unalloyed good, but it can be unproductive and wasteful as much as it can be productive and beneficial.
I do want to give Professor Chen a chance to respond to that. Go ahead, Professor.
Yeah, so I agree with Kevin that you don't want to go too fast, and definitely you don't want to sacrifice quality. You know, so there are examples in China, for example, of rails that have been built too quickly and there has been accidents. or housing that's been built too quickly and they just sit around empty, right? They're called ghost cities. But then at the same time, Kevin and the listeners brought up another great point, which is China's not really the only comparison here. You know, there's also Europe, Western European countries, Northern European countries with political processes and regulatory standards that are much more similar to the US. And for these countries, the cost of building a highway, of building any infrastructure, is usually a third or less in the United States. And I think that tells us that we have a lot of room to improve.
Yeah. Well, Alyssa Fry tells us online that Alyssa visited her folks in Zurich and was astounded by the fact that every train, tram, and bus was perfectly on schedule to the minute. Might be related to the fact that the streets of Zurich were in perfect condition, according to Alyssa. No potholes, and drivers respected the lanes and the rules. So we'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next week, just a heads up, we're going to be talking about healthcare workers in the United States. There's evidence now that one in five healthcare workers has quit since February of 2020. Yes, since the start of the pandemic, 20%. Another 30% are considering leaving healthcare. So is that you? Are you an American healthcare worker? Are you burnt out? Have you been feeling moral distress? Have you thought of leaving the profession? Have you already left? We want to hear your story. 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today, we are talking about President Biden's bold claim that because of the $1 trillion Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, the United States could catch up or even surpass the quality of its infrastructure in comparison to, say, China. China is the president's favorite comparison, but we ought to look at Europe as well. And we're just fact-checking that assertion from the president and asking what it would really take to actually get U.S. infrastructure back up to a world-class level. I'm joined today by Nancy Chen. She's a professor in the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University. She's with us from Chicago. Kevin DeGood joins us as well. He's director of infrastructure policy at the Center for American Progress, and he's with us from Washington. And we have been hearing so much from you, listeners, about other places you've seen around the world and your wish list for infrastructure here in the United States. For example, here's Bob Frick in High Point, North Carolina, and he wants the United States to reimagine roads.
Canada and Mexico do a much better job with their roads, number one, in terms of roundabouts, whereas in the United States, we have nothing more than stop signs and stoplights to control the flow of traffic. Also in Mexico, you have smart stoplights, where not only do the stoplights warn you when the light's going to go from green to red, but they also foretell you when they're going to go from red to green. So if you see a red light and it's getting ready to change, you can adjust your speed.
This is Bird Jensen, who's currently in Australia.
So regarding infrastructure that's working, here in Australia, we do pretty well. Our taxes pay for what I consider to be excellent roads and bridges, trains. I can't fault it. I'm really happy with it. We take care of our infrastructure. It's not crumbling.
Professor Chen, a couple of minutes ago, you said something really important because we had heard Jun Zhu talk about the pleasantness and the high state of repair for the roads that she travels on in Shanghai. But China still has an immense traffic problem, right? I mean, the having the surface look good and not have potholes hasn't solved a fundamental transportation issue when it comes to cars in China.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, all big cities and highly densely populated areas have to deal with congestion. You know, it's just very difficult. And then the trouble that China has, you know, and compared to other countries, is its high rate of economic growth, you know, which is actually a blessing and a curse when we talk about traffic. It's a blessing because, you know, the country's growing, people are doing better off, the government can afford to spend a lot on infrastructure to provide these people with roads for their cars and subways to help them not have to drive. At the same time, the number of drivers are just increasing so fast in China. In 2020, there were over 281 million cars. That's about 204 cars per 1,000 people in China. And if you want to compare it to the U.S., the U.S. has about 279 million. That's around 816 per 1,000 people. Mm. So if Chinese car ownership rates will reach the same rate as the U.S., the number of cars will more than triple. Right. So China has the same length of highways as the United States, even a little bit longer. But it's just going to have a lot more cars because it has a lot more people and they're getting richer. And despite the fact that public transportation and rails are improving at a massive rate, you know, people's demand for cars are increasing at an even faster rate.
And so what does the Chinese government want to do about it, if anything?
So, you know, as far as anyone can see, they're pulling out all the stops. They're doing everything they can. You know, one is what we already talked about is just improve public transportation so that people don't need to drive and that people don't all need to work or live in the city center. Another thing that they've been doing is just to build more roads, to widen the roads. Another thing they've been doing is just to increase the cost of car ownership. So to give you an example, owning a car in Shanghai costs over $10,000 just for the license plate, right? So that's like a tool that they've been using, but, you know, how much more can they increase the price before you make a lot of people who just can't afford that very unhappy? And then on top of that, there are all sorts of rules, you know, when congestion gets really bad or they predict it to be bad, or if there's an event or an important visitor where they have to close roads, where they just don't allow people to drive that day. They'll just say, you know, odd and even license plate numbers, even can drive on Monday, odd can drive on Tuesday. So they're pulling out all the stops, and it's just a difficult problem.
Yeah. And so, and then there's the additional problem that comes with many, many, many more cars on the road, which has to do with air quality, for example. We're getting a comment here from Jennifer Hill who says, come on, China is choking on pollution. Faster? How about cleaner? Kevin DeGood, what do you think about that?
I think that's absolutely right. And I think a few numbers can help to try to get at this notion of rebalancing our system and the efficiency to be gained from making smart investments in public transportation. So here in Washington, D.C., the Orange Line, part of our subway system, connects Northern Virginia to the District of Columbia. And during the morning and afternoon rush hour, that system can move 15,000 people an hour into D.C. Now, if we think about a highway lane, your average occupancy in a car during rush hour is 1.3 to 1.5 passengers, give or take. And you can move about 2,000 cars per lane per hour. So that one subway line can remove 10,000 cars from the roads, or roughly 5 full highway lanes versus vehicles per hour. So when you think about the limited space that you have in dense urban areas, and the desire to grow and have that be an efficient growth, public transportation is truly an effective solution. But it typically needs to be paired with congestion pricing. So a lot of the trips that we take We could take them at different times. We could take them on different routes. Some of them are of sort of low marginal economic value. And there's a great deal of research over the last 35, 40 years that shows even a modest price can result in fairly big behavioral changes. People are willing to carpool. People are willing to try transit. And so really, it needs to be a combination of investments in the physical infrastructure, but also changing how we price transportation services.
Okay, so that brings up this important point that makes the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act a meaningful step forward, but by no means a silver bullet, right? Because I mean, the cost of expanding public transit in the ways that both of you are talking about will not be covered by the portion of the Infrastructure Act that is dedicated to transit, not by a long shot, Kevin, right?
That's right. But we should also recognize that the federal government is just one part of this equation. In fact, the majority of infrastructure expenditures are carried out by state and local governments and special districts like transit authorities. Just as, you know, to put a few numbers on it, highway expenditures, depending on the size of the state, the federal government is only providing about 25% of total highway expenditures. In smaller states, it ranges up closer to 30 or 35%. But again, state and local governments are the ones raising the bulk of this money. So it's a partnership. But we should also recognize that there are huge efficiency gains that we can unlock just by simply repurposing a lot of what we have. And one of the places where we've seen this in larger metropolitan areas is something as simple as bus-only lanes, right? We've built this huge arterial roadway and highway network. Again, to put a number on it, we have 785,000 lane miles of arterial roadways and highways, and that includes the interstate system. But how we prioritize the use of those facilities could change greatly and could unlock a lot more productivity and efficiency. So having a bus-only lane where a single 40-foot city bus could carry, you know, 40, 50, 60 people, depending, in the same space as maybe two passenger cars with single occupant, you know, drivers. There's a lot that we can do, but it takes political will as much as it takes money.
I can't help it. Boston drivers, we've got some bus-only lanes here in our home city where WBUR is. Stop using them when you're driving. Stop double parking in them. The bus-only lanes work if the buses can travel down them. Okay, off my soapbox on that one. We've got a comment here from Bill on Facebook who says, when you marvel over things in Europe, remember that those countries have put heavy taxes on everyone to bring about things like metro transportation and giant works such as Germany's fabulous Autobahn. Think your taxes are high in the USA? Question mark. So, Professor Chen, that same question to you about the cost to really achieve the kinds of systems that we've been describing here. I'd love to hear you on that.
Yeah, so I want to say two things. One is that, you know, we pay a lot of taxes in the U.S. There's a sense that you pay much higher taxes in Europe, but actually taxes are pretty high in American cities if you add up federal, state, and local. Just a couple of days ago, I went to lunch with my parents, and they noticed that we pay 12% tax on our lunch. You know, so I don't know that there's a huge trade-off there. Maybe we should focus our attention on just how we can lower the cost of construction in the U.S. And the second point I wanted to make is to build on what Kevin said. I think Kevin is absolutely right. The federal government is only a part of the equation. And this goes to the point that I think everyone's been making, that in order to make this happen, President Biden needs to get, he needs not only to get a lot of money from the federal government, but also to get state and local governments to jump on board and, you know, to all want to do this. And I actually think this is one of the reasons why China keeps coming up in the dialogue, in the president's dialogue, relative to say, hey, why don't we catch up to Austria or France or Italy? And it's because, you know, bringing up China and invoking these thoughts of political competition, economic competition with China, that's just a coordinating device that he feels like, you know, many different parts of America and the American government can jump onto.
I mean, to put it bluntly, unite around a common enemy. An interesting political tactic here. But I want to actually, you know, play a couple more clips from some listeners, because we just heard a ton from folks who've been around the world here and what they wish we could have back in the United States. And some didn't actually have to go very far. Here's Tricia Steiner, who lives in the San Juan Islands in Washington State's Puget Sound.
The British Columbia ferry system is gorgeous. They have big, beautiful ships with lovely places to eat and shop, and they are just world class. Whereas if you go across the border into the San Juan Islands where I live, we have dumpy old ferries that are 50, 60, 70 years old, and they are just an embarrassment.
That's Tricia Steiner in the San Juan Islands in Washington State. There's also the question of energy infrastructure, a big part of the bill. And here's Ian Barnacle from Providence, Rhode Island.
A couple of years ago, I had the experience of traveling to Copenhagen and seeing the amazing Amagerbakke electricity plant. Electricity there is generated by burning waste from 500,000 to 700,000 inhabitants of Greater Copenhagen, and then turning around and powering approximately 150,000 homes. On top of that, the roof is actually, of the structure is actually built slanted so that it can accommodate an artificial ski slope and tourist attraction. And I think this is one of the most innovative projects I've ever seen in the world. And I'm very hopeful that the U.S. can incorporate projects like this.
That's Ian Barnacle from Providence, Rhode Island, reflecting on what he saw in Denmark. So, Professor Chen and Kevin DeGood, we only have about 2.5 minutes left. This has been a fascinating conversation. But I want to return to what's being heard, what we've heard over and over again from listeners, and that is the visceral feeling of how far behind critical infrastructure is in the United States, that visceral feeling people have when they see what it could be in other countries. So I return to the question of, you know, what would it take for the United States to achieve that, you know, that world-class infrastructure that President Biden envisions? Kevin, at the beginning of the show, you said we could get there in the next 10 years, maybe longer. I'd love to hear your top one or two things of how we get there then.
It's a great question. I think we have to step back and recognize that infrastructure expenditures are deeply political, because anytime you're building major facilities and spending billions of dollars, you're creating economic winners and sometimes economic losers, and that the burdens from infrastructure spending can also be unequally distributed. So if we were to say, spend billions of dollars expanding our port infrastructure, ports generate lots of harmful emissions and the people that live around them, you know, have to bear that burden. So one of the things we have to do is design expenditures that create inclusive prosperity and shared benefits to try to create the political coalition that allows you to get that momentum, so that this isn't just a one-time boost or infusion of federal funds, but that this is an ongoing increased expenditure for years to come. But again, it needs to be designed in a way that people feel like they're benefiting and not just being excluded.
Well, Professor Chen, we've got 45 seconds to go. Not that much time, I apologize, but you've done such detailed analysis. I mean, where would you begin to really meaningfully push the United States forward?
So I think it makes sense to start in the cities where the gains are obvious. The old, very highly populated cities like New York, Boston, Chicago, where the infrastructure is obviously old, where there's obviously gains. And once that's done, you know, people will see the benefits and hopefully we'll get the political momentum that Kevin was talking about to do more.
Doesn't sound like either of you, though, think we can get there in 10 years, but at least we can try. So Professor Nancy Chen, professor at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Magna.
And Kevin DeGood, director of infrastructure policy at the Center for American Progress. It was great to have you as well, Kevin. Thank you.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Stay safe out there. This is On Point.